Hi, Tarek from The Morning After. Welcome to a Morning After podcast. This wasn't on the air. It's just right here. And let me tell you that we're going to talk to Janet Hoy Gerlach, a professor at UT and a big part of the HARP program, something you might have seen me talk about on Facebook Live or seen me mention somewhere on social. It's mental health patients and animals. I'm one of them, and I love my animals, specifically my dogs. We've got a lot to talk about with Janet, who is a professed Star Wars fan, including suicide and lots of mental health issues, and the book that she wrote. And it's all about HARP, and it starts right now.
I think that I'll keep loving you way past 65. We made a language for us two we don't need to describe. Every time you call on me, I drop what I do. You are my best friend, and we've got some shit to shoot.
Please let me welcome Dr. Janet Hoy Gerlach. You have so much on your signature in your emails. I'm going to get all this right. Associate Professor, Social Work Program, School of Justice, College of Health and Human Services at UT, right?
That's correct.
Do you shorten that? I like to make acronyms out of things. We need to find you an acronym. How do you introduce yourself?
I would introduce myself as Janet Hoy Gerlach. I'm an associate professor in the Social Work Program at UT.
That's easier. That's so easy. Yeah. So Janet is here to talk about the HARP program. Let's start backwards, because this has been your baby for like the last 8 years, right?
Really, Susan Conda, a philanthropist in Toledo, came to the Humane Society with the idea in 2010, and I was and still am on the board, and the executive director at that time, John Dinan, connected us and really...
So Susan, who... Susan's been like, she was her brainchild, and I know she's a philanthropist, as you mentioned. Her family has a lot of resources. You've been like the steward of everything, correct? Is that a good way to put it?
We kind of put it together. She really, has a passion for helping people living with mental illness and a passion for animals and needs. And I had a lot of the programmatic building kind of knowledge. And so from her vision, we really, put it.
And that was like 8 years ago. And we'll come back to that. But since this is like our first chance to get together and chat, are you wondering like how the heck I got involved with this? Because I'd be happy to explain.
Yes, that would be great.
Doing my radio show, I had very little to talk about because I don't connect with people real well, because I don't have like a big family or wife. My social life is very nominal, but I have my dogs who I love to death. They're my children, which you can relate to. And I've always talked about my mental health struggles, which is bipolar too. So when the old show got axed, my friends at ProMedica, who I'd worked with, said, "We have something that you need to investigate. We're working on this HARP program." And they're like, mental health and medical patients and dogs. I'm like, I'm in, no more, say no more. And ever since then, I've been looking forward to all the meetings that Gay has put together and that to get to know the process and everything. So that's how I got involved with it. Dogs and mental health,
that's the program.
That's it. It's 99% of my life. So take me back to HARP, which is Hope and Recovery Pets Program, correct?
Correct.
So how did Susan approach you, or how did you get involved in this? What went off in your head where, it went off in my head? Like, dogs and mental health, yes.
Yeah, she has a very similar perspective in terms of her own animals' impact on her. And as we were introduced and started talking informally, and immediately I connected not only with my own experience with how my animals have helped my mental health, but working as a social worker with adults with chronic mental illness. One of the things that struck me for some of the people that had animals was how important that bond was for their well-being.
Right.
And I think I mentioned when we were at the My Dog is My Home art display a bit, I also worked on a crisis hotline. And one of the things I always ask people when I'm doing a risk assessment for suicide is what stopped you up until now from acting on your thoughts. I mean, for some reason they're talking to me, they're alive, whatever that reason is, I want to know it. That's the lifeline often. And, you know, there's the usual suspects, my kids, my religion, I'm afraid I'm going to screw it up, I'm scared to die. But often enough, and perhaps it's probably because I am an animal person, so I was paying attention to it, but fairly regularly would come up, I don't want to leave my animals behind. And I was, I guess two things struck me. One is my God, like, people are literally kept alive by their bond with their animals.
Yeah.
And the second thing that struck me was I was never taught to assess this. I was never taught to look for or ask about that. And really,
about the animals?
About, you know, do you have an animal in your home? How, you know, what is that like for you, or how important is the animal to you? Because that can be such a powerful factor in helping people.
Sure.
Not only, you know, caring for the animal, but that can help motivate people to take care of themselves.
It's strange that something like that would never arise in the education of a social worker, because I guess it's, you know, who's important to you, what's important to you, and like, again,
we would look at, and we always talk about in
people
social
and jobs,
work, starting where your client is at. You know, not, you don't have to be an animal person to honor and respect the bond somebody has with an animal. And that's how I approach it when I teach it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, certainly with me, it's easier to maybe empathize because I have such wonderful life enrichment from the company of my animals. They're my family to me.
Right.
But a person doesn't even have to have that perspective to be inclusive and recognizing of what that can mean for other people. And literally, you know, it can be the matter of a difference between life and death.
Absolutely. I was lucky when I was examining my mental health challenges and with bipolar too. Like, I read up on this stuff. Like, I wanted to arm myself, and I did. Mm-hmm. So I dove into books in addition to continuing with therapy, and I learned about the damage. I like to call it like emotional shrapnel that flies from suicide. And I know that's touched your life as well. And
it has.
And when I was younger, and we're talking like 25, 26, I immediately realized, okay, no matter how hopeless and dark I feel, like, I can't do this, because mostly for me, for my dad, but also now, like, when I have those dark moments, because I having this depression comes there, especially now when you can't go outside and get a little vitamin D and there's a dark day. I think, you know what, when I think about the world without me, I'm like, who and when would they find my dogs? And it sounds, and I can laugh at it because I try to make light of it to loosen the mood with other people who have a hard time talking about this. But it's true. The last thing I want to be thought of is if I were to do something like that, is, look at this. This jerk off let his dogs 3 days without food or anything like that. Because they help me get rid of those ideations. Mm-hmm. They are powerful components. That's why, let's move forward a little bit with the HEART program. And there was a pilot program, correct, with cats?
We had cats and one dog.
Okay. And the whole goal of this is to, well, if you could put the science behind it a little bit and explain some of the program.
And the goals of the program, the goals are really twofold. One is to really leverage the natural benefits of the human-animal bond to improve people's mental health and well-being, particularly among people living with a chronic mental illness, as opposed to like a situational, you know, you've gone through a stressor, so you have a couple months of different, which can also be really debilitating, but it's a different sort experience.
I like to, not to speak into your terms, but I try to relate to people. You're depressed. You don't have depression. Now, one can morph into the other, but like, when something bad happens, you got to find a way to cope. But if it lingers for a long period of time, okay, maybe now it's
interfering with your ability, you know, to function in one or more life areas, or making it much harder to. That's more of a chronic condition, illness, you know, whatever term people, you know, prefer or are comfortable with, but it's an ongoing.
If you lost your job or a family member, you should feel down. You should absolutely feel down.
We have the spectrum of emotions for a region. They have functions for us. Mm-hmm. They're actually adaptive.
So you can speak to it, as you alluded to a little bit. I certainly can. How these animals can enrich our lives and act like medicine. And that's what the heart program is aiming to do,
really?
Correct?
Yeah. I mean, the benefits that human-animal interaction, mm-hmm. so even just interacting with a therapy animal that maybe you've just met, say you're in a hospital, somebody brings an animal to you, if you have a positive view of animal, I mean, if you're afraid, allergic, any of those things, it's not going to be beneficial for you, of course, but if you have a generally positive regard for animals, several things will start happening pretty quickly after you start petting the animal. Mm-hmm. And one of those things is
you can use the O word.
Oxytocin.
It's a buzzword of mine because I read a pretty popular neuroscience book, mm-hmm. and it was referenced rather often, so that when you brought it up in the committee meeting, I was like, I know what that is. It's basically like when a mom breastfeeds their child, it creates that paternal and maternal bond, right?
It is the bonding hormone. It happens, paternal, maternal, between adults who are hugging for a prolonged period and like each other. I mean, mm-hmm. that needs to be there too.
I guess a more layman's way of going about it, people have heard the word pheromones, something similar to that where there's just a connection between people.
It's a physical chemical that's released in our bodies to, when somebody gives birth to an infant, it kind of facilitates that bonding. Other species have it too.
Mm-hmm.
To varying degrees, and like creatures that mate for life may have high oxytocin, releases with their mate. So mm-hmm. it's not even just us, but oxytocin is associated with a decrease in heart rate, respiration rate, blood pressure rate. So if you think about a stress reaction or anxiety for somebody that's living with, kind of a chronic anxiety, some of those physical symptoms are exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's also sort of the mental or psychological feeling of well-being we can get from having, physical contact and comfort with an animal that's responsive and friendly and attentive to us, doesn't,
compassion.
Appear to be judging us in any way.
Of course, yeah.
So all of those things, that's kind of the physical. I mentioned the mental. Then if we go into like more of a psychological place, I mentioned people saying that, they couldn't leave their animals behind and that's why they hadn't mm-hmm. killed themselves. That's really a sense of purpose, sense of feeling needed and, a reason to be, if you will, for people. And then certainly the social benefits, there's the direct benefit of having the animal to interact with, someone to greet you when you come home, hang out with you while you're, doing your Netflix, whatever. And then there's this indirect benefit, which is basically animals can help facilitate and increase social contact with other people.
Sure.
Kind of like the conversation we're having now wouldn't be happening without animals. And there's been research that shows, just walking down the street with a dog, so many more people are going to make eye contact with you, smile at you, talk with you than would happen if you were by yourself.
My older dog, like I mentioned before we hopped on, my older dog Diddy has peed on countless people in downtown Toledo. I try to pull him away and they see how excited he is and they know he wants to say hi. And I'm like, he gets a little excited. They're like, no, it's okay. And up he goes, and it comes out. It comes out. So, no, you're right.
Yeah, they're definitely, one of our current heart participants lived in an apartment building, alone for years. Didn't really speak with anyone there. After she got her cat, one of the other residents saw her cat in the window and mentioned it to her when they were getting mail together, and it turns out that resident was a cat lover, and for whatever reason didn't think she could manage a cat, but started coming over to visit the heart participant's cat, and they ended up having tea several times a month on an ongoing basis. But that happened because of a cat face in the window.
Yeah. So this is the HEART program, Hope and Recovery Pets program to help connect mental health patients with a chronic illness or a chronic ailment with the right animal for them to bump up that oxytocin. I have a question. This is why maybe the question that I've longed to most ask you
Sure.
in our meeting so far, and now is the right time for it. You do the research. Like, I visited with a woman last week, and then if she gets an animal, she'll be tested 4 times a year to see if the oxytocin goes up, right? If she finds the right animal.
We'll be looking at oxytocin, also cortisol, which is a stress hormone to go down. Alpha amylase is another stress indicator. And then, like, some standard or traditional survey kind of measures of anxiety and depression
right.
and loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And also, at the end of 12 months, what we'd call a qualitative interview, which we're doing now, asking open-ended questions
yeah.
to find out each person's perceptions of what it's been like for them living with the animals, how, if any way, that's been different for their, you know, mental health and well-being.
The information is extremely helpful, and I get the world of research that you live in, where you've got to prove things quantitatively, especially to get the large sums of money to move programs like this forward. Of all the things that people say they need data for these days, the human-animal bond seems like last on that list because of all the anecdotal stuff we've talked about anyway. Look, I know there are some like animals that create terror for people. Maybe those are just bad animals or the bad match. But as you and I are great examples of that, that might keep me alive, and you don't have to test my oxytocin. So what is, do you just want to see what you know down on paper?
It legitimizes it.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, you said there's a lot of anecdotal
yeah.
evidence, but for a big healthcare system like ProMedica is really a leader in what we call the social determinants of health,
mm-hmm.
which are kind of the social factors, like having an animal that can impact health.
Right.
But again, like I mentioned in my social work training, not being taught to attend to that, it's typically just a underlooked, underutilized resource in people's health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from asking about it to involving, you know, parts of interacting with the animal into people's care. And in order to get that legitimacy,
the data's got to be there.
It's really the funder of the research, the Kenneth A. Scott Charitable Trust, is actually a funder of more animal sheltering kind of programs. But their hope is that a national model will come out of having the data through the research that can be presented to other humane societies to help them partner with healthcare systems to get more placements, good placements for animals.
Let me ask you this way. Have you ever been more confident in any research you're doing that it will turn out the way you're expecting it to?
I am...
This seems like the sky is definitely blue kind of bet.
Yeah, it's a good bet, but with research, you just...
Right.
I mean, I could have people that are nervous because new people are coming into their homes
sure.
or they think they need to be... You know, any of those things could set the physical indicators off.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always tried to approach it with humility and know that it'll be a learning experience. Do I believe that the people that are applying to participate are going to be beneficially impacted by the animals? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what is the data going to show us,
right.
you know, in terms of, are we looking at exactly the right things? I mean, it's all, you know, we're using the best indicators that are pointed to right now. But
I'll give you a quick anecdote of my own from a couple of years ago. In the middle of 2012, I had moved away from like my home area, which is Philadelphia. I was living an hour away, so I could go back and forth to home pretty quickly. My dog and other family dogs were in Philadelphia, so I would see them often. I moved to Detroit in 2012, and around like 6 months through the year, it had been a real crummy year. Just job stuff, everything, nothing was going well. In fact, I took like a week off of work and shut everything off. And this was still in, like, the Facebook era. Like, I was incommunicado. You couldn't find me. And I was talking to my dad about this, and he said, maybe you miss your dog. And I kind of scoffed at it for the moment. And then 2 weeks later, I kind of had this wild hair where something subconsciously in my head thought about it and said, hey, there's some dog adoptions. And, you know, long story short, I went and adopted my dog. And it was one of the, you know, best days of my life. You know, Dad, in this case, Dad knew best. But he was right because he had seen all of, my whole life. I had dogs around me. Yep. Yeah. And he knew that I was unwilling to get back on any kind of medication. I'd had some bad encounters with side effects. And they were worse than dealing with the illness itself. Yep. So he's like, go get the dog. And the dog was a headache sometimes, but breaking the dog in, thankfully, he didn't have to be crated. And it was really good. And now, you know, I love him to death. And I do wonder, as you talk about with big healthcare systems and seeing where the data leads, I do hope that, I know that you and Susan have your pie in the sky for where this could be in a national program. I hope that this has some kind of impact on helping mental health patients, maybe weaning them off of medication, or saying, instead of, I take Cymbalta. Instead of Cymbalta, how about a Labrador? And then you'll have the data to back that up. And I know, I always tell people, look, just because we have the same systems or the same symptoms, what works for me isn't going to work for you. But this would be such a great outlet because there are so many people who love animals, cats and dogs. If a hamster gets your oxytocin up, so be it. And people who are unwilling or maybe unable to pay for expensive medication, here. And you get some exercise out of it. So that's kind of like where I hope this can ultimately be, because healthcare is expensive, as we all know.
Yep. And, you know, I don't know that having an animal would be interchangeable with a medication in terms of how we're affected. Probably wouldn't be. But in terms of benefits and, like, more choices for people, I think that is tremendous, because what you say about medications, that's not unusual.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people have to sometimes make such tough choices.
You want to pay?
Do I want to be sane, but not able to have an orgasm and gain 50 pounds? Or do I want to be off my medicine and having horrible mood swings, but be thin and, you know, it's sexually tough. Active in a way that works for me? Like, that's a difficult choice.
And maybe they're not interchangeable, but maybe that there's
degrees. Maybe it can offset some of the difficulties enough to where, you know, some other resources, you know, it's definitely a protective factor.
Or you hear
in health.
Some people maybe hear it's going to cost you like $1,200 to $1,500 a year potentially to take care of your animal, and maybe that scares somebody off. But it could potentially help the anxiety you're going through. Or maybe if you're a woman living alone, and it's especially in this climate, you want to have some protection at home or whatever. As opposed to, well, it's going to be $1,000 a month for that medication that isn't covered under your insurance. I'll pay the $1,200 a year for this awesome animal. So I'm fascinated to see what the data for HARP will all play out to, and how this is going to affect the larger world.
Like,
if you can get a plant or a coloring book that improves your mood and saves you a couple of bucks and maybe helps you get away from some side effects you don't like, whatever works, right?
The more options we have, the more likely, you know, someone's going to find something that feels right for them. That's an individualized way of, you know, helping their mental health to improve.
Some other things. You wrote a book this year, last year?
I did.
What was that about? And how stressful was that?
It was a project.
Yeah.
It was definitely a life experience. It's called Human-Animal Interaction, A Social Work Guide. And the gist of it's really about helping to equip practicing social workers to recognize and support the human-animal bond in routine social work practice across practice areas, you know, be you in child welfare, mental health, domestic violence kinds of situations.
Like two
older adults, every, you know, social work setting, you're going to be with people. And the majority of people in the country, according to the American Pet Products Manufacturers survey, they have the biggest demographic survey in the country. I think it's 68% of households, well more than half, report having at least one animal. The majority of those consider their animals to be family. So mm-hmm. if you're working with people, you're going to be working with people that have animals. You should expect that and have some ability to respond to that. Again, not necessarily because you're an animal person, which is great and makes it easier, but because it's good social work. It's good professional right. practice.
Right.
And it helps get better outcomes for people if you attend to what's important to them in terms of their family and, you know, social support. So, I mean, there's, of course, information about animal-assisted, you know, interventions and animal-assisted therapy, service animals, emotional support animals, sort of more of the specialized and formal roles that animals have in helping people.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important to know when there's a lot, like, HARP, for example, is an emotional support animal placement program. So definitely, you know, lots that people can learn about in terms of how animals can help people.
Mm-hmm. Can you quickly explain, as a quick tangent here, what an emotional support
yes,
animal is?
I would love to, because there have just been so many stories coming out recently of people either, you know, just flat out misrepresenting their animal as a service animal. And
trying
taking
to get them
out
on a plane.
In public, or people that take an emotional support animal out in public, thinking that their animal's in fact a service animal and should have public access rights, and it's actually made things more difficult for people that need actual trained service animals, typically dogs, to help them navigate out
right.
in public. So an emotional support animal, that's a legally recognized term. They're basically pets or companion animals that have been recognized in writing by a licensed mental health professional as being therapeutic and needed for a person's mental health. And again, the person under the definition of emotional support animal would have to be a person living with what legally is referred to as a mental health disability. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially a chronic mental illness where one or more of your areas of life functioning are interfered with by symptoms.
And then who can certify these animals?
There are a lot of bogus online sites and to get your service animal vest and a letter and... or an emotional support animal vest and a letter and, you know, 10 minutes and 200. I mean, very exploitive. And it should be from the person that knows and is working with your mental health care. And, you know, on a letterhead, letter signed, dated, several components are important, that, you know, your name, that the person is knowledgeable of your treatment needs, that... the presence of an animal through the natural benefits would help alleviate the distress and impairment related to the mental illness.
Right.
And signing it, dating it, keep a copy in the chart. Person should have a copy. And that letter conveys the emotional support animal legal status.
Gotcha.
So what rights do people have with emotional support animals? They basically the animal's considered a mental health accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
So under there's two areas of federal law that come into play.
Okay.
Once the animal's identified as an emotional support animal, one is the Fair Housing Act. An emotional support animal, because they're recognized as a disability accommodation, aren't considered pets. So they can't be charged pet fees, deposit fees. If it's no pets permitted housing, your emotional support animal is not a pet. Your emotional support animal is considered an accommodation for a chronic disability.
Yeah, we talked about this with the woman that we visited last week, thinking that if, like, they wanted to charge her, like, a pet fee now, it's like, oh, no, hold on a second. These are certified right. animals. So things like that should get waived.
Right. And, a lot of times it's, you know, maybe just about educating people who, you know, would be cooperative. They just need to better understand what
right.
an emotional support animal is and isn't.
Mm-hmm.
The other piece of law that comes into play, which is I think more controversial because of some of the abuses that have come up with it is like the Air Carrier Access Act allows...
You don't need your emotional support animal on your vacation in Aruba.
So there's provisions for air travel, which is like... you know, if somebody's like, we had a person that moved out of state and didn't feel he could take his cat with him. If he wanted to fly with his cat, that he should have been able to do that with no fee.
Right.
What happens is people are like, ooh, I want to fly for free with my animal in my cabin, you know, on a seat next to me. And I 100% understand not wanting your animal in a cargo hold. It is dangerous. Animals die that way. Many animals like being flown as cargo with the luggage. So I get why somebody might think, oh, I want my animal in my cabin, but it's fraudulent.
Right.
And it really makes things difficult for those situations where somebody might really need to get from point A to point B with their animal, not necessarily for vacation. And that's where you hear a lot in the emotional support boa constrictor on airplane, you know, frightened, where you're just like, oh, seriously.
I understand you like your pet snake, but still.
I understand not putting your animal in cargo, and I would never advocate that to be an option, but also, you know, falsifying a disability status is not the way. Either, but so those two pieces of law, what animal emotional support animals don't have is public access through the Americans with Disabilities Act.
So they can't come to the gym with you. They can't.
No.
They can't come to the mall with you.
Those not are... under Americans with Disability. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so I you know come at that. I did do some expert witness testimony for the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights on emotional support animals. So I've had some help. Kind of building my understanding from a non-lawyer perspective of the laws around emotional support animals, but public access, no. If a facility says it's okay, like they want, oh, you can bring your emotional support animals in, that's up to the business. Like they can certainly do that, but I think a key thing is emotional support animals don't have special training,
right?
Like to behave like we've talked about your dogs and. How you're...
They'd lose their minds.
One sweet boy likes to pee on people in excitement.
There's a guy that I used to see at the gym. He had some type of physical disability, and he had a retriever with him. Like, that dog has special training that emotional support dogs do not typically get.
Right.
And there's a big difference.
Service animals or assistance animals are task trained, so they do things specifically to help a person related to their disability. And they're extensively trained to behave in public, so...
They don't listen like your dog does, right?
No. No, I actually have a dog that did not pass service dog training. That would be Mabel, the one that the lab that I said kind of clunks into.
Right.
She has a heart of gold, you know, she's got the loving temperament, but she just doesn't have, like, the regulation. And she gets a little anxious in public, which, you know, you can't have...
No, those dogs are stoic.
Somebody running off when the truck backfires with somebody with a mobility disability, like trying to hang on. Like that's just not.
No pun intended, but those service dogs are another breed of animal.
Yes, and so somebody bringing an untrained emotional support animal into a store that
bad idea.
Carries on, then makes it more difficult for people with. Legitimate service or assistance animals to come in. They're being challenged more, and that's
if you need your dog or your boa in this case to go to Walmart, then there's probably a bigger problem that should keep you from shopping anyway. Let me go back. This book was stressful. I have some friends who have written books and editors, deadlines, rewrites. Was it a challenge?
It was definitely a challenge. And then, you know, we talked about suicide. Mm-hmm. And I lost my brother to suicide in the middle of the book. And that was definitely...
That's why you were out at the walk at International Park, correct?
Yes.
Correct? That's the first one you'd attended?
I had gone to one a few years back.
The Out of the Darkness walk.
Yeah.
That's where I met your wife and your dog, one of your dogs, right?
Correct. You met Henderson.
So you're writing the book and your brother, what was that? it's always a surprise, but were there symptoms? What was going on, if you don't mind me asking?
He struggled with depression, and it wasn't his first attempt, but he started drinking heavily after a breakup.
Mm-hmm.
And he's was in Vegas, so I went back and forth there a few times to try to help him.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he went missing, and I got a call from the coroner's office that they'd found his body. I'd done the missing persons report, so I had to call my parents and tell them that their son was dead, and my sister, and it was really tough. And I think being in the profession, mm-hmm. you know, having done risk assessment, I teach risk assessment, I've published an article about it, it really kind of took me to the bowels of my soul, so to speak.
Right.
In terms of, you know, just trying to make sense of it. It's not... it's a wound. It's not a clean wound. It's a messy... I mean, I think a death of anyone we love is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And the grief around that. But this was kind of a particularly messy... In terms of the coulda, shoulda, woulda, what could I have done different?
I mean, I would assume anyone that's been connected to anything like that would ask themselves that question.
Right.
And that's probably what a lot of people who attend that walk have to work with therapists. And the therapists probably tell them, you did everything you could. You know, this was not you that put anything in this person's hands. So.
I mean, that he... denied having suicidal thoughts when I went with him for some help, like right in front of me, having told me, you know, that's somebody that was pretty serious about acting on the thoughts. When I'm teaching students risk assessment, one thing I will say is, you know, it may feel scary for you to be, you know, having a conversation with somebody that's thinking about killing themselves, but the thing is, they're talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
Which means there's some ambivalent somewhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody that's not talking at all. They kind of made up their mind. And I think there's always the possibility for change and for intervention, but they're kind of further along in their thought process. So just the fact that they're talking to you is...
It's good.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's a strength. It's something to work with. It's the people that say nothing and don't tell anyone and don't want to be found out. I was with him after his first attempt, and he was furious when he woke up and said, "I can't even do this right."
Right.
And he was not happy to...
I can imagine. I can imagine.
...be in the hospital having his stomach pumped. So there was a big, 20 years between his first and the one that killed him, and he... go ahead.
What was there any... kind of treatment for the depression?
He got medication from his primary care doctor. So I think, you know, he wasn't very open to therapy. You know, with medication, he struggled with, you know, some of the side effects of medications, like, you know, anyone who takes a medication does. Like mm-hmm. we said, there's always a cost benefit to it. And so he kind of went on and off with the medicine. But I think the stigma, too, around... you know, having depression, like he never went to see somebody who, you know, specializes like a psychiatrist that might be able to have given him more options.
Right.
And then when the drinking escalated.
Yeah, which will magnify the depression.
He stopped going to work.
Right.
Got evicted, was living out of his car and basically living at a bar. And... just, you know, an awesome human being. So, I mean, but depression can
mm-hmm.
can get, you know, it's all walks of life, all people. It's mm-hmm. not about being good or bad. I mean, he was one of my best friends, Star Wars geek like me. He had lots of friends who loved him, you know.
And the depression clouds you from seeing that.
Right.
This is all the things that I talked about when I was lucky enough to do a TED Talk and talk all about this, because I'm very open to me. Like I said, I have very little to talk about besides my dogs and what's going on in my head. And nobody wants to hear all my nerdy Batman stuff.
So I might, but that'd be a different conversation.
I do everything I can to... I like to say that I like to be the voice for people who can't or won't have one. And I never you know, I will tell people that my therapist is great and I'll give you his number, and my PCP is great with medications, so I trust him with it, as opposed to someone who might need to work with a psychiatrist, but he's great.
Mm-hmm. And some are wonderful and they know your whole body and that can work much better. But yeah, it's just...
But I always try to tell people, look, you know, I can't help you, but I will be more than happy to tell you that there's nothing wrong with this. Like, you didn't do anything wrong. You were born this way. This is the way the chemicals in your body. All I try to do is try to let people know that, you know, there's someone out there that can help them. And I have a friend that it sounds like your brother a little bit. He mentioned some of this stuff to me, some really scary stuff that he never mentioned before. And now I make sure to check up on him, because when he's not talking or not talking about that, I get a little concerned. And then the least I can do, because I'm not with him all the time, but he's a friend and he's got some really dark demons that... He tells me he doesn't want to pay for the medication or the side effects, and it's always an excuse. So the best weapon for me, for him, is just remember me and your friends, like your friend Melissa and your girlfriend. Just remember that, you know, if you do anything to yourself, we're all going to be very upset and very angry at the same time. So, because I can't push him to anything, because I can just remind him that there are people there that care about him.
People that care, and he's not alone. He may feel alone, like you said, that depression. It one of the symptoms of depression is hopelessness.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And that's like, you know, when you're talking to someone who's hopeless, you know.
It's the cloud.
You know that it comes and goes, but to be talking to somebody when it's there, it doesn't seem or feel like it's going anytime soon. And maybe there are no other options. Or I even talk with people that I think this is where my brother was at. He felt like a burden. Mm-hmm. Like, he felt like it would actually, we would be sad, but we would get over it, and it would be better for the people he loved if he was gone.
That's where I often, and I try not to get real heated with this argument, as opposed to like a Star Wars argument, when I bring up the word selfish when it comes to suicide, because that's the two ways. There's people like me and your brother who are solely looking for a way out. Like, I don't want to feel like this anymore. I never consider myself a burden to others, but I know many, many do, and that's where the word selfish becomes troubling for those people. But it's awful, and you know,
feel selfish. It may feel selfish for the people that are left behind and are hurting, but in the person's head, it may be the opposite. I mean, in some cultures, it's actually considered an act of altruism,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, if you dishonored your family or I get that it can feel like, you know, you just got a whole bunch of pain because of what somebody did, and that could feel like they were being selfish. But was it selfish? Like, a lot of times, like you were just saying, like it's because people don't want to burden their loved ones, or they see no other option.
And sometimes something the episode or whatever is so extreme that it is a burden, but I'm sure most people, and I talk a lot about this in my TED Talk. I'll
hear your TED Talk.
You watch my TED Talk, I'll watch your Oxy Dog video.
Oh, mine is a goofy little spoof.
That's fine. That's fine.
Of,
Never mind. We can move on, because I do have other questions for you.
Okay.
Wait, we never finished the book. How stressful was writing this book?
Well, it got pretty stressful,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, it went a few months past deadline, which as books go is not unusual, but it
angry
was...
emails, right?
Actually, my publisher was wonderful.
Okay.
I mean, the publisher is the National Association of Social Work, which is the largest professional social work organization in the country, and they have a peer review process, which means they sent the manuscript to some experts in human-animal interaction that are social workers, but certainly they were, you know, I was honest with them, mm-hmm. about losing my brother, and they were very,
I'm sure they would be,
willing.
Yeah.
And my co-author, Scott Wayman, he's a former student of mine and practices in Minneapolis now, was likewise wonderful. So, you know, I had a few months of... We talked about those dark spaces that sometimes, mm-hmm. come because of things that are external. Like, mm-hmm. that was where I was at for a bit. But
who does someone with your background, do you talk to somebody?
Therapist?
Yeah.
Sure, okay. I think anyone can benefit from a therapist.
Right.
A good therapist.
Right. Yep. 'Cause I go back to like the old, remember, did you ever watch The Sopranos?
I have not, but I have seen bits and pieces of it.
The therapist would go to the therapist, and I've never encountered a situation like that in real life. Yeah. But I'm thinking that, yeah, people who take all this external angst from others all day long, they've got to have their own outlet.
So. And it certainly can include therapy. And sometimes we're the most difficult ones, the therapy clients, the therapist therapy clients, because we're like, I know what you're trying to do. Well, I say that. Or
I know a lot of times because my bookshelf is like Psych 101, so I know there's a lot of times where I just need to go to my therapist and I know enough exercise and techniques that I just need to say it at someone and hear the words and I can help myself. But I know a lot of people aren't like that. Some people are. Some people, you know, sometimes can just hear the answers come out of their own mouth. And I'm sure it's similar for a lot of therapists who go to therapists. Because you know what you should be doing. You're just not doing it.
And sometimes I'm flat out clueless, too. So I wish the therapist say something. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Like, why did I not think of that? Tell them no. Yeah, huh. I can do that? Okay.
Yeah. It's like you become an actual patient, a real person. Yeah. Like you lose all the wit. What's the name of the book again?
It's called Human-Animal Interaction, A Social Work Guide.
Is it out somewhere now?
It is. I can get you a copy.
Okay. What about, like, is it on Amazon, iBooks?
It is NASW Press right now and in process of getting on Amazon.
Okay, cool. You'll have to keep me updated on that. My last question that I wanted to get into was over the summertime, because all my job stuff, and they dropped the HARP nugget for me with my ProMedica friends, I guess, in June. And then I think I had a meeting with Gay and Randy, I think in July. And we were exchanging some emails, and I think Gay asked me if, and Gay, we'll call her the board chairperson of HARP.
Yeah, she's in charge of, or the program manager, program director for HARP. She manages the operating fund and oversees the operating committee, and then we have an advisory committee that you're on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so she...
To just bring people up to speed with Gay Martin there from ProMedica, she said, did you read the article in the paper about HARP? I'm like, well, I'll have to check that out. And then I'm like, and it's okay, we're not on the air. So Walker said, you've got to be fucking kidding me. The woman who is trying to help mental health patients, medical patients with animals, has dogs, and you got cancer? That was not something I was expecting to see in that article. What the heck happened?
I am 46 years old, so 4 years before, you know, the recommended age for colonoscopy, I was having fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
I have a really good primary care doctor, Marilyn Agee. Thank you if she ever hears this, because I literally feel like, you know, she saved my life by not blowing it off. Because some people, you know, it's
I'm wait till you're 50.
Middle-aged, I'm overweight. I work too much. I don't exercise. And I mean, like, I don't sleep enough. You know, I mean, like, all the things that could cause fatigue and for her to, you know, eat healthier, get some more sleep, exercise, you know, get some of the weight off. But she definitely says all that stuff to me. So I don't want to
not like
minimize that.
Ordering tests or anything.
But
right?
She, you know, recognized that I was describing something that was different. And she took that seriously and, you know, tried iron and blood work and ended up sending me I was anemic.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't figure out why, and so she started sending me for tests, and a colonoscopy found cancer. It was colon cancer, but that probably would not have been found. I mean, I had no plans to get a colonoscopy, let me tell you.
Right.
It's not on anyone's top of their things to do list.
Stuff.
No. So I was bleeding internally.
Oh, my God.
And that's what's causing the anemia, so... You know, had surgery at ProMedica and was actually able to see my own dog, Henderson, which was just amazing. He came after the surgery. My wife brought him. And that, you know, there's different parts to having cancer. There's, you know, first hearing it and even like saying I had cancer is kind of surreal. Like I'm not entirely used to it. You know, so getting the diagnosis is definitely like a whole thing. And then there's the like... How far has the cancer gone?
Right.
When Henderson came, we hadn't found out about lymph node biopsy, which is basically if it gets into your lymph nodes, then it can go...
It's metastasized.
Right, all around your body. It's just that's a different scary level stuff. Of... Yeah, so yeah. Was I going to need chemo? Was I going to need radiation? You know, what were the next steps? You know, how much of a... I mean, the cancer is, you know, something that maybe never... I mean, it can always come back.
Sure.
So there's that, but I mean...
You're clear now, right?
I am cancer-free at this moment.
So, so your doctor was literally like a superhero. She was like a Jedi Knight.
She was my Jedi for sure.
She literally saved your butt.
And actually, the first time, like, she'd given me... I didn't even follow through, so she had to kind of get after me. So, yeah, she's definitely a Jedi Knight doctor in my book.
But I was stunned when Gay says, read the story about HARP. Here I am going to read it all about this program that I'm 110% even more behind. And here, you had cancer, and you, in a sense, almost became like your own data point.
For sure.
Because the picture from the Blade article, which people can go look up, is with you in bed. I think your wife is there. And Henderson's there, right? That's the picture in the paper?
That's Henderson. Yep, and yeah. I was definitely needing that reduced, you know, physical wound up, all the things our bodies do when we're stressed. Oxytocin was, you know, I'm sure I would have enjoyed a therapy dog visit from somebody else's dog and gotten those benefits, but there's nothing like, you know, your own dog who loves you and, you know, you love to pieces and just and being able to lay there and snuggle.
And they can tell when you're not feeling well.
He was different. He just, you know, back to his boisterous self, but he was very careful, and he's always been a Velcro dog.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, he, you know, follow me everywhere. Anytime tears, mine, my wife's, our son's, like he licks them. He's always just done that. Maybe he likes the salt water, but mm-hmm. he'll also whine and like put a paw on you and cock his head. I mean, he kind of shows indicators. Beyond, like, I want to eat your salt water. Right. So, of responsiveness. And, like, that's not taught. That's just him.
Right. They're smart just, animals.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely an emotionally supportive dog, if we want to talk about emotional support animals.
I know I like to... Sometimes I slam cats. It's only in jest. But there is something that most dogs have that cats often don't. It seems like most dogs have that ability to learn about the DNA of their owner and their caretaker, however. Like, I don't know if cats do that, but I know that all dogs that I've been around have.
I actually have had pretty profound bonds with a couple cats, too.
You were lucky then.
I'm very lucky. And a horse. And so. Horses, I believe. Yeah, I was a kind of a barn fly growing up. I mean, we couldn't afford having horses, but I worked at a stable and took care of several other people's horses and kind of, you know, fell in love with one, and I would sit in his stall and he'd put his head down and I'd press my forehead on his, and, you know, stuff that you might cringe seeing a kid do now, like, well, you're going to get stomped.
Right.
But, I mean, he was wonderful.
If you ever want to see more horses, I have a friend. My friend who works at Lucas County Canine Care and Control, she has, her name's Laura Simmons. She has lots of horses. And I'll do simple math because I don't know exactly how many. Let's say she has 5 dogs. There's only like 15 legs. She takes home, like, all the handicapped dogs, and she's got a lot of funny horses and stuff. So, 2 last questions. With all the stuff that you do, not to sound like your doctor, but can you not work, like, 18-hour days? Can you chill? Can you take a vacation? You sound like you're doing a ton.
I would be doing it anyway. I mean, I do take vacations.
Good.
Have a hard time staying off, you know, email and like not staying on top of the projects
hard.
Because it's much more than work for me.
Yeah, it's a life.
Yeah,
it's a life. I know what it's like.
So,
did you like The Last Jedi?
I have mixed feelings about that. It really was, you know, they're kind of moving away from the whole Skywalker legacy thing.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, I know, you know, like the recycling of themes over and over again, like they probably need a new direction to take it. But I'm old school, man. I saw the 77 when it came out. I think we saw it like 13 times. You know, it's just hard for me. Is it Star Wars if it's like going in this direction?
Right.
So I
agree.
I want to like it.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
There's parts of it that I'd like. Like, I don't know, Luke throwing the lightsaber over his shoulder.
You didn't like the humor?
Well, that kind of cracked me up. And also right. The lightsaber being split in half when Kylo and Rey were fighting. I mean, like, the lightsaber was like this sacred, mm-hmm. you know, unbreakable, at least that's how I always thought. I mean, the idea that two people could be fighting back and forth over it, like, you know, fighting over a toy and then it broke in half. I mean, I think it was supposed to be...
symbolic in some weird way.
Right, but it just sort of cracked me up. Like, right. Like Luke threw a, you know, lightsaber over his shoulder and now this one broke in half? Like, what's...
I did like the general hugs part. That was funny. Though it did remind me of Spaceballs.
Yeah, like I said, the humor is definitely like not quite...
I like it. It wasn't very Star Wars-like, but it wasn't too foreign. But I'm with you. And if you can't recycle, like, family drama over and over again, then you should get out of movie making, because Star Wars is like a couple of things. Scary Darth Vader, lightsabers, and a lot of family drama. And I guess my biggest gripe from it is that, like, Kylo's not... like, there's no villain now.
Yeah, he's, like, definitely, you know, shades of gray. Like, 50 shades of, like Jedi gray. Or
he needs a therapist more than anything
else.
Yeah,
he's got, like, parent issues.
Yeah.
And
anger issues.
Inferiority complex.
It's
and,
all over.
You know, well, I mean, what is it? The Force Awakens, when the stormtroopers are running away from him, not because he's scary, but because they're, you know, showing like they don't want to talk to him because he's annoying like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I guess, I mean, it sort of speaks to the complexity of villains, I guess.
Or it's just modern movie making.
Yeah.
For a millennial generation, right?
Right. Like, nobody's all good or all bad. Although, Rey kicks some butt.
I like her a lot.
Yeah.
She was kind of like minimized in this, but to deference to Luke. And it's hard to fit everybody in. Like, I think the number one complaint that I've seen is that casino scene was, one, unneeded, but definitely too long. And Finn's just kind of like a bumbling idiot.
It's like people don't get enough airtime. I mean, there were, yeah, definitely some things that could have been cut out to let some of their main characters get More Rey.
Scarier Kylo. Instead of, it's like somebody got an email and said, hey, remember when we emailed Benicio Del Toro and we were thinking we were going to have him in that and he never got back to us? Well, he got back to us. And he said 20 minutes and $10 million. And then, I don't know. Well, we've got 2 more years to the next one. 2 more years, and we'll see who Rey's parents are, if they're actual nobodies or they turn out to be somebody.
And are Kylo and Rey gonna hook up? I mean, what's happening? Is there like tension there? I don't know. I'm like, how is this? Is just not Star Wars. This is, I mean,
like, he's not even evil. Like, you're not even a bad guy.
You have some sympathy for him. I don't mean, he's annoying, but I don't know.
He's annoying, but he's not. Like, when Darth Vader walked into the room, everybody shit their pants.
Right.
There is no shit their pants from Kylo. It's like, let's hope he can keep it together.
I mean, he already killed his mentor and wants to run off with Rey. I mean,
Luke or his dad?
Well, no, I'm sorry, not his original mentor.
Killed his dad.
And then he killed
Snoke.
Snoke. He killed
Snoke. Well, he was a jerk.
He was a jerk. I'm not saying he didn't deserve to get it, but, okay. I mean, you know, there was no, like, deference. Like, we're trying to rule the galaxy together. It was kind of like, I'm going to kill you so I can be with Rey and hopefully she'll rule the galaxy. I mean, it's very different than, like, the Emperor Darth Vader dynamic.
Like,
or
that was ruling scary. We're gonna make this one giant, like, dictatorial empire. Like, Rey and Kylo could have just summed it up after episode 8. Said,
I could see them, like, going to Hawaii or something. Like,
yeah.
Let's get some, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Some fun on the beach. I mean.
Well, this has been a fun hour. Thanks for taking some time. And,
thank you.
I look forward. I'm going to see the oxytocin video with the dogs acting poorly.
Yes.
Yeah, so and we'll keep an eye out for the book. And again, thank you for your time. And here's to Harp working out, not just here, but everywhere, for everyone, for people like us, for their benefit.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome.